This is part B of our conversation with Ladislav Henry Gold. If this is the first time you're hearing this, make sure you go back and check out part A.
That is unbelievable. The question that I have is, did the young lady get to see all of this, get to see the elephant?
So, you know, I don't know what she saw, because the end of the story, if you will, was this. I sat there. Now, I sort of pulled myself in a kind of a sitting position. And then I sort of said, well, you're not going to get up now because this is really, really stupid. So I sat there and I said, well, maybe I'll see if she heard me, if she can hear me. Maybe she saw something, maybe she didn't. Maybe she heard the elephant. So I yelled her name. She didn't respond. I yelled a second time. She didn't respond. So I said, all right, let's give this one more yell and see what happens. And I yelled very, very loud. And then she responded very literally, sort of just beyond the trees. So I said to her, Stephanie was her name. I said, Stephanie, but her voice cracked. So I said to her, Stephanie, stay calm, because if you don't stay calm, you are not used to me and I need help right now. And I said to her, and she responded sort of saying, Henry, I'm fine. And then I said to her, you know, there's a phone in my bag there, and I need an ambulance right away. And she said, I have my own phone and I'll call the ambulance. She didn't call the ambulance. She actually called our tour leader who was ahead of us. I don't know what she saw, because she was traumatized somehow afterwards, and I never wanted to ask to her. She was more traumatized than I was. Perhaps because I was always willing to talk about it right away. Something I think I learned from my mom, that if you want to go on living properly, you know, you got to deal with your trauma right away, drama. I have no idea. I do see her. She's still on a Facebook.
Oh, really? if she was that traumatized, she would have had to have seen what's happened, you would think.
Well, let's do a call out to Stephanie.
let's hit her up on Facebook and see if she actually could recall that for us. That is an amazing, amazing story, Henry. And for you to actually survive that is quite amazing. When you think about all of the different rides and expeditions that you've had, is that the most, well, I was going to say,
the most stomped on you've been?
Was that the most frightening moment that you've ever had? I mean, that you said you were pretty calm throughout that process, but is that the most frightening moment that you've had, or have there been other, you know, more frightening incidences along the way?
Well, for me, that would have been one. I think we had some other, but I wasn't on them. We are caught in a crossfire Tajikistan, on the Silk Route 1 year, where an incident just kind of happened when we were having a rest day. And I think, you know, that was international news, it was a major incident. But again, fortunately, nothing happened to us. There's certain behavior pattern I learned again between when I was working in Africa. When you are a visitor, whether a tourist or anybody else out from outside the country, you're not under threat from whenever the trouble are, but there's a civil war, etc. Generally, you know, they're at each other, and they're not interested in you. They're not interested in getting attention from international media and the world around it, that innocent foreigners are getting killed. So there's a behavior pattern that you simply have to stay calm. And wait it out somehow, you know, and not expose yourself. You do more damage to yourself when you're panicking and you start running and you get hit by the crossfire. You know, the best thing to do all in a situation like this is, as I told the people when they were communicating with us, is stay calm, sleep on the floor if you have to. Don't walk around to see what's happening. When it's time to move, we'll tell you. But that was a complicated situation, because it wasn't just us, there were other foreigners in there were NGOs in there, And it was a crazy incident because basically what happened was a general of the army was killed there by some opposition group, and the army decided to move in. Literally on the day we arrived there, we were resting. So that was a pretty scary situation for people who were there. Again, some were scared, some were not. You know, some stay calm. We had another situation in South America. The first time we were doing the South American epic, which starts in Colombia, Cartagena, and goes all the way to the tip to Ushuaia. And we were there. We sort of have a knack of doing this thing, just like Africa. We were there when it just becomes obvious that it could be done. So we decided, as you may know, Colombia was in a serious civil war. There were a lot of problems there, but things were starting getting calmer. So we decided to plan this thing. We sort of took a calculated risk 2 years before we went, that this is going to be doable in 2 years. So we did. And we came, and literally a first foreign group cycling through the country. About day five, we were cycling on a road. During the night, we heard a large explosion. So we were cycling and again, I was in the back, and our tour leader went ahead with the vehicle. And about 50 or 60 kilometers from where we started, actually the bridge we were supposed to cross was destroyed. As I said, our riders are sort of spread. They had to bring him back together and keep him calm, because, you know, a lot of these people come on this adventure. Some of them are, you know, want to test themselves. Some think they're fine under pressure. They're going to be fine when unknown things happen. But the truth is exactly opposite.
Yeah. You know,
some people who think they're going to be calm are panicking, and those who you think are going to panic are staying calm. So, you know, you have to chat. It wasn't a threatening situation whatsoever. But there were several people that were asking, can we organize a helicopter to get him out of here? There was absolutely no threat to them, none whatsoever. And, within 24 hours, the bridge was fixed and we moved on the same way the next morning.
Right. So if you think about TDA today, and you've got this, you know, amazing business that helps people tour all over the globe on a bike, why? What's the mission behind TDA, and why do you do it?
Because it's there, no?
Yeah, because it's there.
Why we do it? Look, what happened to me on this Tour d'Afrique was something I never expected. I didn't anticipate it. I, like everybody else, I had no idea what we are up to. And I thought it was going to be once in a lifetime, an adventure of a lifetime, and that's about it. But then I discovered that, you know, you were talking about the Tour d'Afrique. Our assumption, by the way, to break even on the trip, not to lose any money on the first trip, the Tour d'Afrique, was that we're going to have two trucks, two big trucks. And by Nairobi, half of the people will decide to go home because they're going to be, you know, they're just going to have enough of this.
Too hot.
You know, where there's no, you know, almost lack of water. You eat. And, you know, you need to eat all the time, and there was just not enough food to eat all the time. The resources were limited. It's not like you could go shop in Khartoum, for example. There was no supermarket. You know, in order to buy meat, we had to go to a meat store. And then in order to buy pasta, we had to go to a pasta store, and so on. So we sort of thought that, you know, this is by Nairobi, people would quit. Half of them anyway. Well, but 2 days out of Nairobi, I was lying in tent, and I said to myself, I don't get it. I just don't get it. People are hungry. They're dirty. They're sleeping on mats that, you know, hardly can get sleep sometimes for a variety of reasons. You know, there's all kinds of stress. We never knew where we were going to sleep because it wasn't organized that way. You know, the distance is very approximate. And I just kept saying to myself, you know, what's wrong with them? why aren't they going home?
Why aren't they going home?
And there was one guy, actually, a wealthy Canadian, who kept asking me when we are going back now, because he wanted to go home, but he couldn't make himself to go home. You know, he didn't want to quit. He didn't want to be a quitter. So he kept asking me all the time, how are we doing financially? How are we doing financially? How are you doing financially? So they didn't quit. And I think one of the reasons they didn't quit is because they were all discovering things about themselves that they never realized. They were also touching, I think they were touching part of their brains they never thought they really had. You know, the whole experience was so unique. And still is. Whenever you go on these long trips, I say it takes about 2 weeks when you're beginning to enter a kind of a different perspective of what's important, what's life, why you're doing this, and you need to do this about 2 weeks, and then beginning to disconnect from the modern society. It's kind of very interesting, but there's a whole attraction to this, you know. There's a way of life. And of course you are continuously, because you're doing it day in, day out, you know, you're feeling good because of the endorphins you're producing. And so there's a whole cumulative impact here that's often hard to describe, except for people who have done it, you know, whether it's these long trips or any other trips. So why do I do it? I do it because I discovered something unique. And because I think you want to share this with people who, you know, we were like a brotherhood, on the group that goes this long distance. It becomes sort of a commander unit. You know, you pull together, you work together, you help each other, your bike breaks, somebody else helps you stop. You know, it's a very unique. Also, because on these trips, what happened is, you know, people from all around the world. So, you know, people perceptions change completely. Young with the old. We also sort of created a bit of an egalitarian approach where, you know, whether you're rich or whether you're poor, whether you come from whether you are a doctor or a factory worker, everybody's the same. You know, we ask everybody to wash the pots. We cook for them, but the pots have to be cleaned by the riders. And, you know, I have had people on these trips, very wealthy people, who said, I have never washed a dish in my whole life. And I said, well, you will here. And he said, no, I won't. I said, yes, you will. And then he says, well, I'm going to pay someone to do it. I said, no, you won't. You know, I would sometimes look at these characters, you know, out of the corner of my eyes, for the first time in their life, they're washing a pot. Well, they couldn't really wash the pot. You know, we had to show them and teach them how to wash a pot. Take a scrubber and scrub. And, you know, eventually they did it, you know. It would be something that every 4 or 5 days people take turns. You know, we have a team of 2 or 3 people working on it. But again, it was something that's a unique experience in the modern world. It happens maybe in the military. It happens in a, you know, probably in the firemen and other groups that work together under threat. But I think this is very unique, what we created. And like I said, I never expected it. And I just, you know, people came back to me, all of them, you know, to this day. You know, I got an email today from a fellow who did 10 of our trips, who came on, I think, 2006 or 2007, our trip. And then he again, a fairly wealthy individual. Because he can afford coming on this trip. Very strong, very strong athlete. But I got a letter, email today from him for, you know, a whole page telling me how thankful he is for what he provided and how he changed his life. You know, he came back from Africa and then he set up a chapter of Bikes for Humanity, and he's been raising money and sending bicycles to Africa. This is one of the things we've been doing. So, it has tremendous impact. That was part of my attraction, by the way. Why Tour d'Afrique in the first place was, you know, I worked there for 9 years in a non-for-profit. And Africa in those days, today, even today, you know, the people that go to Africa, they are either professional aid workers, or they go on safaris, or they're businessmen who go there to make as much money as possible and leave. And very few people get an opportunity to really spend time in Africa in a different way. And the whole idea of Tour d'Afrique was, let's bring some people so they get a different perspective on Africa. So they spend some time in a village. We would sleep in a, you know, local soccer field, football field, and the villagers come and talk to you, and then they inquire, they're interested, and then you start playing ball with the kids, and you know, it's a very different interaction than being a tourist in another way. And of course, bicycle, you're so vulnerable on a bicycle too. You know, it's not like you're driving through a country in a car where you just wave at the people or you stop at a gas station or whatever. It's very different on a bicycle. They understand this, you know. You serve like one of them. They see you sweating. They see you dirty.
Yeah.
They're not intimidated by some person who's coming along. So I was going to say,
you're in it. You're on a bike. You're in that country, right? Yeah.
Hey, yeah.
I'd imagine on these long, long rides that you and the people that go through this experience that you do, you'd learn so much about the culture of the countries that you're cycling through. You'd learn, about the place, the geography, the country itself. You'd learn about its people. You'd learn about the people that you're cycling with. But I'd imagine there's a lot that you learn about yourself through that experience. When you think about what you've learned about you on these rides, is there anything that stands out?
Well, it sort of goes back to what you said, you know, that I was determined. I was shocked and surprised that I actually ended up basically cycling the Tour d'Afrique, and I realized, hey, you can do stuff. You can do anything. If you make, if you set your mind to it, you can do it. I mean, it's a cliche, but the fact is, if you expose yourself and challenge yourself, you'd be surprised what you can do. And I tell this, by the way, all the time to any, when people hear about what I do, I said, I could never do this. I could never do this. You know, I'm not in shape. The whole thing, you got to be super athlete or you got to be, some extraordinary people. And, when I start showing them example of people who come on this trip who are 60, 80 pounds overweight. But guess what? Within 2 weeks, they're doing 100 kilometers, no sweat. Because if you don't speed and if you don't race, on a bicycle, you can do 10 kilometers an hour. And guess what? 10 hours, you've done 100 kilometers. And you can do it slowly, you can pace yourself. And psychologically too, I have so many examples of people who came on this trip. The most important thing coming on this trip is deciding that you want to do this, no matter what shape. We had a blind person that did the whole trip. A Kenyan guy who did with a pilot, in a tandem. Wow. I mean, and by the way, it was a wonderful experience for the rest of us. Because it's amazing how people, if something that you see and feel day in, day out, you see how blind person has to, you're coming to a new campsite, he has no idea where the toilet is. So somebody's got to take him there, every aspect of it. And it's quite amazing how it really gelled the group, how many people were willing to help and assist, etc. All of these things, all the limits we put ourselves are, I always say that, your mind can play any game you allow it to play. But if you decided, to go a different direction, you can do it.
That's a great advice.
Yeah, and you've certainly done it a number of times throughout your life where you've sought out to do one project and it hasn't quite worked out. But as you say, as one door closes, another opens. That seems to be your whole approach to life.
I think so. you can get down about anything that doesn't work. In fact, I'm always excited about starting a new project, something new. And I don't worry if it doesn't work out. To me, what gives me satisfaction is the fact that, yeah, I had this idea or it caught my attention. So let's try doing it. And sometimes it fails because I didn't pay full attention to it or because I had too many other things going on. You can't worry about this. And in fact, you shouldn't because that's not the point. You know, failure is, you know, one of my clients came to me, three, 4 years ago, who said to me, Henry, you know why you succeed? I said, I have no idea. Why do I succeed? He said, because you're not afraid of failure. That was a quote from him. And I sort of, yeah. I never looked at it that way, but he's right. What is there to be afraid of? So you failed, so big deal. If somebody's making fun of the fact that you failed, that's his problem, not my problem. You know, I think I like to quote Beckett's line, fail, fail again, fail better. You know, I think, and the truth is that in some way you're going to measure things. You fail about everything, you know, we fail, we die. So, you know, one should never, and I use the word I failed, but I use it lightly. I say I failed. So what?
When you think about a young Henry Gold, when you go back to, you know, who you were as a teenager, did you have a dream that one day you'd wake up and cycle across Africa and provide bikes to people? And like, did you know what you wanted to do?
No, when I was a young kid, like everybody else, I was into sports. I wanted to be a star in something or other. You know, I wanted to go to Olympics. I follow sports tremendously. But no, I ended up being an engineer because when I was a kid, somebody asked, come visiting us and said, well, Henry, what are you going to do when you grow up? And I just shrugged my shoulder. I said, well, are you going to be a doctor? And I didn't want to be a doctor. So I said, no. So then he said, are you going to be a lawyer? And I didn't want to be a lawyer. So I said, no. Then he said, well, you got to be something. You're going to be an engineer? I said, if I've got to be something, I guess I better be an engineer since I didn't want to do the other two. And I think this is how I stuck to being an engineer. Perhaps that's the first idea of going into engineering. I ended up being an engineer for a variety of reasons. You're an immigrant, you're good in math. You know, it's a stable job. It's a job you can get in any country without, you know, whether you have accent or not. So that's why I decided to do an engineering degree when I went to McGill University. But I had no real plan. I did have a desire from a young age that I wanted to do at least one big adventure in my life. And that's really what was the motivation for Tour d'Afrique. I really wanted to do one. But I also, you know, I also thought that it would be kind of an expedition series of one where I would go with a lot of people and so on. Except that as I got older, and even when I was young, I realized nobody's going to take me to an expedition because I don't fit in. You know, I don't have any particular skills that they need on the expeditions. And as you got older, you realize, well, who's going to take you 50-year-old man who doesn't have any experience in expeditions and doesn't have, you know, particular skills that he can, that are required on these things. So that's why I said to my then partner, Michael, you know, it's now or never. And it was saying to myself, really, it's either I'm going to do an expedition in life once now or never. And if anything that pushed me was that idea from that I wanted to do one big expedition. I wanted to do something that would be considered to be a unique activity. Cycling wasn't part of it. But as I said, when I realized my options are limited, well, cycling is good.
You mentioned early on your parents were survivors of World War II. In fact, you know, they're survivors of the Holocaust. Has that experience shaped you?
Oh, without any doubt. Without any doubt. I'm very much a Holocaust child, first generation child. It's tremendously impacted by that. And in fact, I think the reason I went to Africa first time was trying to help. There was something that in me always that one should do something worthwhile. One should try to fix the world, if you will. You know, there's a whole Jewish tradition that of calling repairing the world, that the world is broken and we have to repair it. So there was part of me there that always felt that I should do it. And I went to Africa because of that. My parents had tremendous impact. Indirectly, you know, they were not the type who gave you any advice or it was really just living with them and watching them. And particularly my mother, she was remarkable. She spent 3 years in Auschwitz, one of the original survivors. She was literally in a third transport to Auschwitz. When Auschwitz was still not a death camp. In fact, she used to tell that she built a death camp because she was building the structures where they were putting the people in. You know, she was a remarkable woman and lost all her siblings. You know, there were 8 kids. They were all and her parents and her grandparents and God knows how many cousins. Yet she had a zest for life that was quite incredible. And again, if there's a lesson here, it's how she told me the story, how she, after the Holocaust, she was planning, she was so down when she found out that nobody survived that she was going to commit suicide. She was terribly depressed. And then a little girl came to her, she was babysitting, and she said, "Don't be so sad, don't be so sad." She made up her mind. Right then she said, "I can't help it, they were all killed. I can't, I'm going to live my life. I was given a life, I'm going to live it." And she lived it. I think since then, she was just given. Look, I'll tell you a little anecdote back to Tour d'Afrique. When I first announced this to my friends in particular, but to strangers, everybody thought, one of the friends told me, "Henry, this time you completely flipped up. This time you're just out of your mind. What do you think you're doing?" So anyway, and then I said to my mother, "Mom, I'm doing this." And my mom said, "Great, I'll see you in Nairobi. I'm going to meet you halfway." And guess what?
Right.
My mom my brother flew in to Nairobi halfway as we were coming in into the campsite in front of the gate. It's my mom.
Wow.
So, that's amazing.
That was her spirit. She was not afraid of anything, of course, because of her experience. But she had that kind of attitude that, why not? And I think that has impacted me for sure.
Well, what we love here, Henry, is your approach to life in general. We can see your parents and their experiences had a huge influence on you, and the way that you've lived your life. And at age 50, decided, I think I'll start an adventure company. Why wouldn't you? We can't thank you enough for being on the Doolanders today and the amount of time that you've put into this interview. So, yeah, thank you again for coming on the show.
We have one more question for you. One more question for you, Henry.
Yeah.
What is next on your to-do list?
Ooh. So I have a whole file which is called New Project. And there are about 50 things in there. And every project, if I take it seriously, would take 2, 3, 4 years to do it properly. You know, I always say some of these projects will only happen because there's coincidences. You know, either I have reached a point where, you know, this is not working, I need to do something else, or somebody else comes to me and it says, has a similar idea and we pull it off. If you ask me what's next, I don't know. I'm playing with a couple of ideas for sure. To me, the important thing is it's not that I have a particular ambition and goal to finish one project. I do have some important. I do have something that I think I would like to do, but if it works out, it works out. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
What is it, Henry?
Okay, well, the main project, I was an environmental engineer essentially, and when we worked in Africa, we did all sorts of things, including planting a lot of trees, over 60 million trees in those days, and I would like to create a bit of a some sort of a call it a reserve in memory of all the people who were killed in different genocides. You know, the Jewish people, the Armenians, the Rwanda. I was terribly impacted when I went through Rwanda. Cambodia, you know, every time I go to these places where there's been horrible massacres, I make a point to spend a day and learn more about it and go to their museums. So I would like to create a sort of a nature reserve somewhere in the world where commemorates all these people who didn't have a chance, who were totally innocent bystanders, who got killed because some madmen decided they want to be in power. It sort of played in my mind. I have sort of started trying to figure out how it would work and what do I need to do and where to do it and so on. But it's a challenging project. It's a big one.
Well, that's an amazing thing to be aiming at. So, hey, Henry, as Nick said, thank you so much for being on the Doolanders. We could talk to you for days, I think. In fact, probably 120 days as we cycled from one side of a continent to another one. Your life has been, what an amazing adventure and what an amazing journey. We've only just been able to touch the surface today, but thank you so much for your time. You've been super generous.
Thank you. Thank you for doing it.
So there we go, Blake. That was Henry Gold.
What a great man. It's so much creativity, innovation, and I really loved the fact that he's got this whole file of new projects and that ambitious project that he's still to do. Geez, I hope that comes true. I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
So you're looking to the distance down the road and there's this massive, great big grey elephant coming at you. You ride towards it to try and scare it off. You turn your bike, you fall on the ground, the elephant's coming at you. What do you do?
Well, I think I've learnt now from Henry, probably don't jump into the fetal position and then as the elephant is crushing my head, think, oh, this is interesting.
Wonder what's going to happen next. Isn't it amazing how his whole world just slowed down and he was calm?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know whether that was on kissing the cod. Probably wasn't.
No. I wonder if he does, you know, have a word to people along the way and say, well, we're going to do hugging the bear. We've got this 75-day cycling trip. Can you tee up bear number 1, 2, and 3 at kilometre 732, 943? Probably not. Hey, Matt, we have – that was Henry. What an amazing man. Loved every moment of that.
Just proves you're never too old.
That's true. 50's just such – like, you know, it's just a small number, really. It's just the beginning.
It's halfway to 100.
It is halfway to 100. It's just the beginning. Now, for our listeners that enjoyed Henry's chat, we've got a bunch of other podcasts and interviews that we've done with other people that have – there's a bit of a cycling theme. Tell us about those, Nick.
There is a little bit. We can go straight back to episode number one, the original, Jenny Pettenon, who, again, not dissimilar to Henry, found out she was an elite cyclist at age 42 and many years on from that is still one of the top 10 ranked female cyclists in the country in the open division.
She's a star.
She is.
Who do we talk to in episode 8?
That's Matt Keenan, who was nearly an elite cyclist. I'd say that he probably was. He just lacked that tiny 1.0% that's needed from a genetic point of view and is now the voice of global cycling.
The golden tonsils, I like to call him. Episode 24.
Bridie O'Donnell, world record holder on the one-hour cycling. Incredible.
Absolutely unbelievable. And newly appointed Collingwood board member too.
Yes.
That
there's very little she can't do, and she even sings at the end, which she puts us all to shame.
Yeah, she does. And a recent episode we did around
episode 43, the great Emma Carney, the multi world champion, sport hall of famer, just one of the greatest athletes that this country has ever seen, and probably actually global triathlon has ever seen.
Yeah, she did stuff that people haven't done since.
Yeah, still holds amazing course records from 20-something years ago. It's quite amazing.
Hey, do you think next week's guest can cycle? Is he a cyclist, do you think, or not?
You're talking about Rob Chell.
I'm talking about Rob, yeah.
Well, I'm not sure. I think he likes a slower walk through the park than he does burning through things, because he loves looking out. And not only, as you'll hear very, very early on in this episode, he has a look out the window here at our studio and starts talking about the type of rock formations that would have made up the land that we're currently sitting on. His view of the world is very different.
It sure is. And it's a fascinating chat and such an entertaining one. He's a really, really entertaining man. So make sure that you listen to next week's episode.
Episode 45.
Rob Chell. See you, Doolanders.
Bye.